Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Anides, and I am joined by my co-host, Josh. Josh, how you doing, man?
Phil, I'm doing great. I'm always happy to revisit the great company that was Strikeforce and analyze what's made the promotion so successful and impactful. And this is going to be a great show, talking about Josh Thompson and Gilbert Melendez. And these guys are so well matched, so I'm really looking forward to talking about this show with you.
Yeah, I am too, and I'll just let the listeners know I am dealing with some sinus issues, and so I may sound a little more nasal than I normally do, so apologies on that, but that's not the most important thing we're going to be talking about today, thankfully. But for those, for our new listeners, this show is called Inside the Hexagon. It's about walking through the major events, fighters, and milestones of Strikeforce, which was a very important and innovative MMA promotion that existed from 2016 until 2013. And on this episode, we will be discussing Melendez versus Thompson, which was the main event was a very long-awaited Strikeforce lightweight title scrap between champion Gilbert Melendez and challenger Josh Thompson. Really the best matchup that Strikeforce could make at 155 pounds. And, you know, boy, did these guys deliver. And so I'm looking forward to talking about this. Show was really all about the main event. Melendez and Thompson brought the house down. But it wasn't really really well attended. Josh, were you surprised by that?
Well, yes and no. The thing I was going to talk about today was how Strikeforce, as great as it was in terms of building those stars that would become big in the UFC, a lot of the shows were a little bit inconsistent. So we'd have these shows that almost filled the house, and then we'd have shows like this one, which were not that well attended. So I think that because Josh Thompson and Gilbert Melendez were, although they were very popular, it was kind of a one-match card. So had they stacked it with a few other people that people had known about, maybe they would have been able to put more people in there. But I think they're just resting it all in the fact that it was two guys in their prime ready to go at it.
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it. And I think we're gonna spend a good amount of this episode talking about that fight. So, but let's jump into the fallout from Shamrock versus Lee. That was the last event before this one. Before we get into that, I did want to mention there was a couple drug test failures that I came across from a past Strikeforce event that I missed. So I did want to bring those up after Four Men Enter, One Man Survives, which was the one-night middleweight tournament won by George Santiago that took place on November 16, 2007. We had two drug test failures. Tournament alternate Dennis Hallman, who had submitted Jeremiah Metcalf with a heel hook at 139 of the first round, tested positive for nandrolone, an anabolic steroid. And then fellow prelim fighter Alex Crispin, who had gotten a unanimous decision victory over Clint Coronel, popped for an anabolic steroid that I cannot pronounce, but I'm going to try. Desoxymethyltestosterone. No, there's no testosterone. It's just testosterone. Desoxymethyltestosterone. I think that's the way to say it. But anyways, both fighters were fined $2,500 and suspended for a year. So apologies on missing that news. I'll tell you, Josh, real quick, I found the way I got this was, number one, when we do this research, sometimes I will find the news of none of the tested fighters tested positive, or, you know, I'll see a news article and then I'll know. And then sometimes I won't see any sort of article. Well, there is a database out there that I don't know how accurate it is, but it claims to have all of the MMA drug tests that have been failed in MMA history. Hmm. And so I went through there. I only found 8 for Strikeforce. So there weren't like a ton of them. And you could say, well, their fighters were clean or, you know, probably just more questionable about the amount of drug testing, because this is way back, you know, before USADA and all that stuff. Yeah. But anyways, that's where I get the information from. All right, so back to Shamrock versus Lee. So after sustaining a broken arm during the main event, Frank Shamrock would be out for a year recovering. The newly minted champion, Kung Lee, would actually never defend the title, as he relinquished it 6 months later due to his burgeoning moving career, which would set up a future title fight between Jake Shields and Jason Mayhem Miller the following year. And you can actually hear my interview with Kung. We just ran that for our last episode, and we actually talked about the fight with Frank. It is such a great discussion, specifically really talking about his mindset and just everything that went into that fight for the title, and then also talking about how movies kind of took him out and that sort of thing. So
do you think,
make sure you check that out.
Do you think, Phil, that that Kong wanted no part of Jake Shields. What do you think would have happened if they actually battled?
That's interesting. I don't think Jake had, so it's, you know, Jake's normally a welterweight. So that's why this is a little bit surprising to me that he ended up moving up to 185. I mean, think about when he went back to Strikeforce, or I'm sorry, when he went to the UFC, he fought at 170 because he took on
GSP.
GSP, right? So, I mean, he's one of those guys that could obviously go back and forth between the two weight classes. You know, there was no welterweight titles, so at that point, so maybe Jake wanted just there. Hey, there's no welterweight division right now. We're not focusing on that. So Jake decides to move up because there's an opportunity to fight for the title there. But supposedly, so anyway, I don't know. I really don't know. But for whatever reason, he decided to go up to 185, and you know, between him and Kung, obviously Jake is not a stand-up guy. So Jake shoots in, takes Kung down. I think he would get him eventually, although Kung did have very good takedown defense, obviously. So but I think Jake eventually gets him down and gets a submission on him. So that'd be my thought. But
He would
man,
just have to survive Kung's
yeah, I
kicks
was
to
gonna say
get
he'd
close
take a
enough.
beating. He would take a beating getting there for sure. So, anyways, but also on that card, Gilbert Melendez had defended his lightweight title against the injury replacement Gabe Lemley, who was in there in place of Josh Thompson, who had injured his shoulder. So Gabe was game, but he lost, and Gilbert was finally able to set up that long-awaited title defense against Josh Thompson. And then lastly, there was originally supposed to be an inaugural Strikeforce welterweight champion decided at Shamrock versus Lee, which was the aforementioned Jake Shields, and he was going to take on Drew Fickett for the title at Shamrock versus Lee. However, Shields had come up injured, so that was pushed back, and we wouldn't see a Strikeforce welterweight champion for another year and a half after Melendez versus Thompson. So, which we will obviously get to eventually. All right, so now let's jump into Melendez versus Thompson itself. On April 25th of 2008, it was announced that the event would be taking place. The only fight announced for that card at that time was Josh Thompson taking on Gilbert Melendez. That was obviously the big fight that Strikeforce believed would draw a lot of fans and eyeballs. The full fight card would be revealed shortly. It included Bobby Southworth defending his light heavyweight title against Anthony Ruiz in a rematch. Jeremiah Metcalf would take on Raymond Daniels, who was a kickboxing star who we will discuss in a little bit. Nam Phan versus Billy Evangelista. Elena Maxwell would be taking on the Strikeforce debuting Misha Tate. Chris Cariasso would be taking on Anthony Ant Dog Figueroa. Jesse Gillespie would take on Dave Martin. Bobby Stack versus Jose Palacios. Alvin Kakdak versus Brian Caraway. Cirilo Padillo versus Jesse Jones. Eric Jacob versus Alexander Trevino. And then finally, Josh Neal versus Travis Johnson, which would not end up happening. But so a few of these fights would not end up taking place, but this would actually be pretty close to the final event card. So adding support to this card would be the title fight rematch that I mentioned, Bobby Southworth taking on Anthony Ruiz. As you might remember, Ruiz had won a non-title fight over Southworth via TKO, coming by way of a deep cut at Four Men Enter, One Man Survives the previous November. Now these two would tangle again, but this time with the belt on the line. And then later on, a very intriguing bout was going to be added as Mr. International Shoni Carter was scheduled to fight rising Strikeforce star Luke Stewart. However, that fight would not happen as Shoni would injure his hand in training and withdraw. And so instead, Joe Diesel Riggs was slotted to take his place. And Riggs was coming off a loss via slam at Strikeforce at the Dome that injured his back and required surgery. So he'd recovered, was going to step in. Unfortunately, Riggs versus Stewart would not end up happening either, which we'll get into the why behind that later in this episode. All right, we like to also give kind of the context of what's going on in the MMA world at the time of the Strikeforce event that we're talking about. So we're going to talk about the UFC champions as well as the closest UFC event, or at least the closest major UFC event to the event that we're discussing in Strikeforce. BJ Penn still the lightweight champion. GSP was now the undisputed welterweight champion after TKOing Matt Serra with knees to the body at UFC 83. This reign would last. It's kind of, well, technically it lasts until the end of Strikeforce, but they do bring in a do they do end up doing an interim title fight, which I believe Carlos Condit won in 2012. But GSP actually holds on to the title until 2013, technically. Anderson Silva was still the reigning middleweight champ. We've discussed that he is the champion champion the entire time that Strikeforce is in existence once he wins the title in 2006. And then when Melendez versus Thompson took place, Quentin Rampage Jackson was still the light heavyweight champ, but that was about to change. We're going to talk about that in just a second. And Minotaro Noguera was still the interim heavyweight champion after beating Tim Sylvia via third round guillotine at UFC 81 in February, with Randy the Natural Couture still technically the UFC heavyweight champion. All right, so the closest major UFC event to Melendez versus Thompson was UFC 86, which happened on July 5th, 2008 at the Mandalay Bay Event Center in Las Vegas, Nevada. The event drew very, very well, getting almost 11,000 in attendance for a gate of $3.35 million. And again, just for context, we'll talk about the gate for this card that we're going to be discussing here, and we'll get into that later, but You know, how exciting was it, I'm sure, for Strikeforce to cross the $1 million gate number for Shamrock versus Lee, which was the biggest event that they could put on that at that time. I believe it drew $1.2 million at the gate. And meanwhile, UFC is drawing $3.35 million, basically almost three times the amount. So it kind of puts things in perspective when we talk about Strikeforce being a legitimate challenger from a business standpoint to the UFC. Josh, I don't know if you have any thoughts, but that just, it kind of puts it in perspective that I don't think it was as much as the competition as most of us would like to think that it was.
Well, yeah, and this is sort of the heyday of the UFC too. I mean, it is really erupting at this time. And, you know, Strikeforce obviously never was on par from a business perspective, but they certainly were on the rise, and they certainly were a company that had figured something out. And as you know, it just takes a few breaks. It takes some national TV and a great fight. It takes just a little bit of recognition for the public to jump on board and think that this is the next really cool thing. I mean, I think that also the difference is Strikeforce held so many of their shows in San Jose, and it was such a regional promotion. Whereas UFC was in Las Vegas, and so they could charge more money per ticket, and they would have just a larger gate because it's Las Vegas, and you know, it's not San Jose. San Jose, yes, Silicon Valley, but it's a different sort of market in terms of people who are going to walk up to the show. So yeah, I mean, definitely the UFC is by far number one, but I mean, I've never seen a number two come as close as Strikeforce did. Now, Bellator's got great promotion, but it's...
It has a lot more money behind it, you know, with
it's
it,
an entire
by Viacom, yeah.
Yeah, Bellator was never from the ground up. It was very much with Viacom basically putting it on, you know, TV and making it work because it's part of their property. So yeah, it's, you know, it's not UFC, but they had a lot to be proud of.
Yeah, and you brought up the fact that Strikeforce was very much a regional promotion in a lot of ways, and they absolutely were. They were very much West Coast based for a long time. Obviously, that starts to change, but they never drew the numbers just as far as attendance goes. They just never drew the numbers that that the UFC would. They never, ever, their first event was their most successful from a pure attendance standpoint. They never got back to over 18,000 again in their 7 years of existence. So
yeah, they try to go to Nashville, practically killed the promotion. So
yeah, which was a whole other, I can't wait to discuss that. That's going to be fun. But they, yeah, you know, they ended up branching out. Obviously they went to Miami, they went to these different, they went across the states, but I mean, UFC by this point, they were doing events in Ireland, and you know, they were already international. So it was just they were so far ahead of the game, you know, when it came to that. And as we learned in our very first interview that I did with Scott Coker, again, available in the archives, but Scott was very much San Jose based. He was very much West Coast. He's still San Jose based, you know? So it's just one of those things where Scott didn't necessarily have this grand vision of, you know, he just wants to have a successful promotion and do the best they can and put on the biggest fights they can. But I don't necessarily know that Scott has, you know, that cutthroat killer instinct that, you know, that a guy like Dana has. And so, you know, I think Dana just had a broader vision and executed it. And so they've done fantastic, and it's yeah, that's okay. That doesn't, you know, not everybody's going to be number one. So, but Strikeforce, you know, again, you kind of put this in perspective that, you know, just with the closest major pay-per-view, they were just not even on the same planet at this point. But anyways, all right. So UFC 86 also garnered 540,000 pay-per-view buys, which is quite strong for that time period. It was headlined by UFC light heavyweight fight between champion Quentin Rampage Jackson and challenger Forrest Griffin. So UFC 86 was truly the culmination of the Ultimate Fighter Team Rampage versus Team Forrest, in that the two coaches finally fought. They did have the season finale was, I think, about a week before. It was technically closer to this Strikeforce event that we're talking about, but I wanted to discuss the closest major event. But it was interesting that kind of they had some issues on that show. Forrest's team had won the competition when CB Dalloway had submitted Amir Sadala in the series finale. Interestingly, Sadala had actually submitted Dalloway in the semifinals to earn his place in the finals, but after Team Forrest fighter Jesse Taylor, who was supposed to be in the finals, had smashed a limo window and terrorized some women at a hotel bar, he'd been sent home. Dalloway earned another opportunity to continue on in the tournament when he decisioned Tim Critter, and then he went on to avenge his earlier loss and submitted Sadala in the final. On the UFC 86 undercard, Melvin Gallard KO'd Dennis Seaver in pretty brutal fashion. That's a KO that's worth looking up. Gabriel Gonzaga got a Keylock submission or an Americana submission over Justin McCulley. And then on the main card, former Strikeforce competitor Tyson Griffin got the decision win over Marcus Aurelio. Josh Koscheck took a unanimous decision nod against Chris Lytle. And then again, Forrest Griffin dethroned Quentin Rampage Jackson via unanimous decision in the fight of the night and won the UFC light heavyweight title.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty memorable event. All right, so we are now arrived at Strikeforce Melendez versus Thompson. It took place on June 27th, 2008 at the HP Pavilion in San Jose, California, and drew 7,288 fans.
You know, I want to just read a little bit from Wrestling Observer Weekly, which is, you know, a newsletter that's, you know, based in the Bay Area, Dave Meltzer, Brian Alvarez, and they were there. So it's just a little bit interesting, describing sort of what happened from that perspective. There were 7,288 fans in the stands, and if you include luxury boxes, which were mostly packed, it had to top 8,000. Paid was about 6,750, which has to be considered a great sign to draw that well without either Frank Shamrock or Kung Lee, even though it was the smallest crowd for a Strikeforce event in San Jose to date. The newsletter notes that the crowd heat also wasn't there for Thompson and Melendez. Obviously, Lee had a lot of supporters, him being a Vietnamese American. And Shamrock, according to the newsletter, Shamrock is the best in the business at building up a fight. So, I mean, that's kind of interesting perspective. Also, Meltzer noted that WWE SmackDown had run the arena about 26 days before the event, and they had about 6,800 people there. So he was sort of talking about how the show at Strikeforce looked like it was smaller because they didn't do the same things that wrestling does to cover the arena and cover the empty seats. WWE has the big set that blocks off the arena, and they sell all tickets together and curtain off the unsold part of the arena. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you've been in fight promotion, Phil, but WWE does that really well. Whoever's there, they make it look like it's jam-packed because they pack everybody together. I was at a house show once, by the way. It was a house show, and they made everybody sit on one side of the building because it just looked like everybody was together. But they're just sort of comparing how WWE had ran that show and made it look packed with less fans. But at this event, it was taped off, and visually it appeared to be a smaller crowd. So that may have played into a little bit of the enthusiasm that we'll talk about in the main event from the crowd.
Yeah, it's one of those tricks of the trade for sure. For Bay Area sports fans, you'll probably know what I'm talking about here, but you know, the Giants and the Oakland A's there's always been this battle of the Bay, but there's really no battle. I mean, San Francisco, the Giants are just so much more popular in the Bay Area than the A's, to the point where like the upper deck of the A's stadium, like if you ever drive by there, I mean, it's been a long time. I've lived in the Bay Area in 7 years, but when I would, you would see like the top area was tarped off, and like the tarps were like sun like wet, sun beaten. Like you could, like they were worn out because that's how long it's been since the A's have drawn, you know, those types of crowds. That, you know, it's pretty common to do that in MMA and pro wrestling as well, that if you don't sell for an event, you know, you just, you try to, yeah, it just looks better, you know, it makes people feel better and it just looks better on TV and all that stuff. So pretty, pretty common. And, you know, I think it's worth, I guess there's pluses and minuses that, yeah, they could draw over 7,000 without Frank, without Kung, you know, that's a good sign for sure. But at the same time, I'm kind of also like, that's the best, probably the most marketable fight that you can put on without like making a major coup and signing, you know, a big like Anderson Silva or George St. Pierre or somebody, you know, a huge UFC star. Outside of signing like a major, major star and bringing them in, or somebody from WWE, you know, so like a Brock Lesnar or somebody like that at that point, I don't, the fact that your probably second most marketable fight, you know, didn't draw double figures, draw over 10,000 fans, I actually wouldn't feel too good about that. I don't know what your thought is, but I kind of feel like it's a little bit of a step back, that that's the best you can do, especially when you consider that when they went to Washington State, if I remember correctly, I think for the Bob Sapp fight, I think it was around 7,000. So I think that was, you know, as abominable as a fight as that was, I don't think it was much better when they, you know, when they did that. So yeah, I was kind of disappointed when I read that personally.
Yeah. Well, part of it too is Josh Thompson and Gilbert Melendez really liked each other. And so there was not this like grudge match that was fueling it. It was more of these guys are former training partners for a short time and they're about even in their skills and they're going to go out there and give their all. And as much as fight fans might appreciate that, great shows need to rely on sort of that walk-up attendance and those people to be just like, oh, there's a great fight. I want to watch that because these guys really hate each other. There's great promotion. And that may have been part of it too, was that these guys liked each other and they were just going to put on a good show.
I think that's very fair. And I talked about that a little bit with George Garcia from MMA Junkie, again, back in the archives, check that out. But we did talk about that a little bit. I'm a little bit more of a purist and I like, hey, it's just a competition and we're not trying to, you know, hurt each other for the sake of hurting each other and all that stuff. But at the same time, the fights that I really want to see are the big feuds. You know, I was always interested in Ken Shamrock versus Tito Ortiz. Would have been super interested in Ken Shamrock versus Frank Shamrock. You know, even when I watch UFC now or I watch Bellator now, if I know that there's some bad blood, and you can tell when it's just talk and then when it's an actual real feud, I want to see that. You know, like that's I'm a pro wrestling fan. Like I want to see feuds. And so with Gilbert and Josh being so respectful of each other, and we'll talk about that when we get to the fight, but being as respectful of each other as they were, yeah, I think that's a little bit of a harder sell. I mean, maybe if they, you know, said something about each other's wives or girlfriends or something like that, maybe they would have sold a couple thousand extra tickets. You know, I obviously hindsight's 20/20, but I think that's a good point. I think they very well could have hurt each other more than, or hurt the attendance and the ticket selling more than they otherwise would have.
Let's face it. Gilbert needed Paul Heyman in his corner, and Josh needed Jimmy Cornette, and that thing would have sold out.
Yeah, this is where having man, and you know, it's kind of funny, like with some of the like Ali and Malki Kawa and some of the different managers you see in MMA today. Man, you could actually see some of these guys going after each other. I think they actually have at times too. I think there actually have been some fights and stuff. So, but yeah. Anyway, all right. Well, let's get back into the event itself. So, as this was another HDNet Fights presentation, Kenny Rice was back on the call, but this time MMA legend and former Inside the Hexagon guest Boss Rutten would be providing color commentary. So, pretty cool to see Boss on a Strikeforce event and calling the action alongside Kenny Rice. So, I was excited to see that. I did want to mention we were able to find video for most of these fights, but not all of them, and we'll make the we'll let you know which ones as we go along. On the other undercard, Alex Trevino defeated Eric Jacob via submission, coming by way of armbar at 37 seconds of the first round in a lightweight a lightweight fight. This is a pretty quick one. Trevino got an armbar and then subsequently got the tap pretty quickly. Very smooth on the ground. I thought Trevino actually looked really good, and I was hoping to see more from him. He would be back in Strikeforce several more times while Jacob would not, but I wanted to mention this. Eric Jacob, this guy, he ended his career at 1-9, which is, as I've said before, I have all the respect for anybody that can step in the cage. Tons of respect to Mr. Jacob for having the guts to do that. But I couldn't believe this as I was looking at his record. All 10 of his fights took place in 2008. That's right. This guy fought 10 times in his career, including this fight, all in 2008, and he only won one of those fights. There can't be anybody else in MMA that fought that many times in 1 year and never, ever fought in another calendar year. I mean, that's insane.
Hey, he's smart. He made his money and left the game. You know, who cares?
I guess. I highly doubt he made a lot of money. All right, so in a light heavyweight battle, George Interiano defeated Travis Johnson via TKO, coming by way of doctor stoppage at the end of the second round. This was the MMA debut for both fighters. Interiano came out here looking like Tong Po from Jean-Claude Van Damme's Kickboxer. He had this long ponytail on the kind of the top of his head, which I thought, man, I was just like, oh, he's trying to look like Tong Po. But this fight was all in the feet, all Interiano. He cut Johnson, who was nicknamed the Last Dragon. Speaking of kung fu or karate movies from the 80s. But he cut up Johnson under his right eye and just really beat him up for two rounds. I mean, it was not a technical masterpiece, but it was pretty entertaining. But yeah, not a huge fan of the ponytail, I gotta say.
Well, let me just say this before I comment on the ponytail. I forgot to mention, and you forgot to mention, Trevino's pink tights. Do you remember those?
Yeah.
So, like, I was like, this is why Dana White wanted to go to, like, Reebok uniforms later on, you know, because those pink tights, those were pathetic. They're just like, I know he won and he was great, but, like, give me a break, you know. They look like they were made by Fancy Pants' mom or grandma or whoever made his clothes kind of thing. But weren't you bothered by those pink tights? Did you notice
them? They didn't really stand out to me too much. I mean, I noticed them for sure, but, yeah, there was... They probably won the award for worst trunks on this event.
At least they extended over most of the thigh, unlike some other fighters. Okay, so you know the ponytail. I thought it was kind of cool because it did look like he was like you had mentioned, he's like a TV fighter or something like that, or a movie fighter. I wondered about the rules and how that would work because I could see in a really competitive close fight that ponytail somehow getting in the way. And I mean, I know you can't pull hair, but I could see in some kind of grappling that it would come into play somehow. So I personally think they should have some rule on length of hair.
I wonder if they do now. One of the things that made me think of was Hoyce Gracie versus Chemo in the early UFCs. Did you ever see that fight?
No. Did they?
You got to look that up because Gracie grabs Chemo's ponytail, which was not nearly as long as this guy's, and he used it like he was using it to like hit him in the face and like, you know, to pull his head. I'm like, that was stupid. You probably, in a sport that had no rules at that point, that was probably kind of dumb. Probably shouldn't have had a ponytail going in there. This guy would have been a sitting duck with the length of this one. I mean, you could have wrapped it around your forearm and just, you know, punched him in the face 50 times. So I wonder if there's some, I've never heard of that, but I wonder if there's some sort of rule against it now. But even if there wasn't, I think it's kind of disrespectful to your opponent because you could totally, what's her name on WWE, Bianca Belair. Like you could totally hurt somebody with it if you're not, you know, like you whip around for like a spinning back fist or a spinning back kick or something and that thing whips him in the face, I'd be pretty mad. So he could have at least
had the gimmick where he pulled it himself and then rammed his head three times into the turnbuckle after he won. Make some money, you know. We need Frank Shamrock to tell these guys how to promote fights. Okay, quickly though, Johnson, you know, getting back to away from the ponytail and talking about this fight, you know, I felt like Johnson did not look like he wanted to be there. He just did not look like he had his heart in it. He fought a little scared, a little bit reminded me of Bob Sapp. I felt like he was just too casual, too cavalier. He was like walking outside to take the trash out. It didn't look like he had any sort of intensity. And he was left-handed. And I don't know. I mean, MMA, left-handed fighters, obviously works for Conor McGregor, but I don't know. I think it's
It's and weird. Rich Franklin. Okay. There are guys out there that have had success being southpaws.
Yeah, it's just weird to watch, you know, the unconventional staff. In boxing, it's a huge advantage. Right. We just don't see
Bernard,
it too much.
Bernard Hopkins, right?
He might have been both ambidextrous.
I'm pretty sure the executioner was left-handed. At least I think he fought southpaw.
I think he switched back and forth. A guy like Pernell Whitaker, left-handed, you know, it's a big advantage. But, in this fight, I just felt like Interiano was just, you know, dominant, and it was probably because of the ponytail.
Very much a stronger fighter. All right, moving on to a welterweight battle between Cirilo Padilla, Nato. He defeated Jesse Jones via unanimous decision. Could not find any video of this, so we're relying on MMA Weekly's recap for the details, and here's what the article said. Padilla controlled the action for the first two rounds with takedowns and ground control as Jones was unable to stop the takedown in the final round. Jones dropped Padilla and swarmed with a barrage, but was unable to finish the fight and again was controlled for the rest of the fight. All right, then we move on to a 140-pound matchup. This would be Brian Caraway defeating Alvin Kaktak via submission, coming by way of rear naked choke at 139 of the first round. The then-boyfriend of Miesha Tate, Kid Lightning Brian Caraway, was 10-2, definitely primed for a good showing and looking at maybe somebody that was going to get a longer look. Kaktak was had fought in Strikeforce a couple times and would be a good test for Caraway. Caraway, jumping into the fight itself, Caraway was on Kaktak like white on rice from the outset. I mean, he shot in for a takedown, never let his opponent get away. He advanced to half guard immediately after getting that takedown, and Caraway was looking for opportunities, eventually securing Kaktak's back and getting the rear naked choke. Very nice showing for a future UFC fighter.
Phil, can I talk a little bit about Brian Caraway?
You may.
Will you indulge me here?
Granted.
Okay, so first of all, Caraway looked great. Like, he went in there all Chael Sonnen, like, takedown. He was intense. Then he turned into Khabib. He was just on the guy, just would not let him breathe. And it was a really impressive performance. And if you're watching that, you're thinking this Brian Caraway guy is going to be something special in MMA. I do want to take note of his nickname, Kid Lightning. Come on, he's just switching around. It's the Lightning Kid. I think that works better. And as we know, as a wrestling fan, you know, that was definitely would have taken him a lot farther in his career. You don't remember that.
Sean Morley, Val Venus. Kid Lightning Kick definitely sounds a lot better than Kid Lightning. Sounds more like boxing because, you know, they have a lot of those Kid X, you know.
Kid Galahad.
Yeah, nicknames, that sort of thing. But, yeah, I'd rather be called the Lightning Kid than Kid Lightning.
Do you remember when he debuted on Raw? He did the first week he was the Cannonball Kid.
Yeah.
The second week he was the Kamikaze Kid. And when he won, he was the Lightning Kid.
Yeah, they switched his gimmicks up a lot. Yeah, I wasn't watching during that time. I just know the history. But yeah. Anyways, well, both Brian and Alvin will be back in Strikeforce in the future, so I'm sure we'll discuss them more in future episodes. In a lightweight match, Bobby Stack defeated Jose Palacios via unanimous decision. Both Stack and Palacios were coming off of wins and both had won in Strikeforce, so this was a good test for both these fighters. Jumping into the fight itself, these two, I mean, it was all action at the outset. Palacios got the better of Stack on the feet, including knocking out his mouth guard, actually. However, Stack was able to get things to the mat and establish himself there. He got a takedown at the beginning of the second round, which he rode for most of the round, getting swept not long before the bell, but not really much that Palacios could do with that. Mostly the same in the third, with Stack getting a nice slam takedown from a waist lock. Clearly, it was a clear decision win for Stack, and that's exactly what we got.
I like the mouthpiece shot. That was really cool. It was a nice punch. You see the guy's mouthpiece comes out of his mouth. And it was just a good slugfest. You know, I like that kind of fight. Did you ever see when James Buster Douglas knocked out Mike Tyson's mouthpiece?
God, I've watched that a gazillion times. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, but there's something about...
It wasn't as good as that, I will say. It was not nothing, as good of that, but...
Nothing as good as that, because this poor Mike Tyson, and I love Mike Tyson, he was so out of it that he took the time to pick the mouthpiece up
and put it back in. That's how out of it he was. Yeah.
It's like hanging out of his mouth. It's like, just get up, dude. They'll put your mouthpiece back in. But yeah, there's something about seeing a guy lose his mouth guard or mouthpiece that you're just like, damn, that must have hurt.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, it was an okay fight. It wasn't fantastic, but it was all right. Both these guys would fight in Strikeforce again, so we'll talk about them more in the future. I did want to mention, we discussed this a little bit earlier, but Joe Riggs was scheduled to fight Luke Stewart. He was interviewed after this fight that we just discussed to talk about why the California State Athletic Commission had denied him his license to fight the day before at the weigh-ins. Again, Riggs was to replace Shoney Carter in his bout against Luke Stewart. And Diesel explained on the mic that he'd been taking 5 or 6 prescribed medications after his back surgery, and the doctor, when he saw the list, said that a couple of them were not allowed, so he was not allowed to fight. He would have tested positive. And so knowing that the commission could not license him, Riggs felt that, you know, he didn't realize that they were banned substances. I felt badly for Luke Stewart for training, cutting weight for a fight that wouldn't happen, but you know, that's just kind of how it works sometimes. And I could see Riggs' manager, Ken Pavia, standing behind him. I think if this were to happen today, there would have been a lot stronger of a reaction to it, because fighters and their management are really expected to know what they're putting in their body and, you know, that sort of thing. But that's why the fight didn't happen. Riggs was on some drugs that were prescribed to him legally, but a couple of them were banned, and so he would have tested positive, so they wouldn't let him fight. So that's what happened there.
Probably better. Would have been suspended for a long time, right?
Yeah, yeah. If he had fought, and God forbid, I believe he said that he felt like the drugs would have been out of his system by the time he got into the cage, so maybe he wouldn't have tested positive. But you know, we always say, and I don't know if it ever happening, but where like a really brutal knockout happens, and you know, so the guy, you know, the victim is really, really injured, really hurt, and then the guy that hurt him test positive for something after the fight, like a steroid that maybe gave him more strength. I mean, God forbid, like something like that would happen. I mean, if Riggs was on stuff, it was pain medication, obviously. So it wouldn't have been that type of situation, but you know, again, better safe than sorry. All right, next fight, 135-pound bantamweight fight between Chris Carriasso and Anthony Figueroa. Carriasso defeats Figueroa via submission, coming by way of rear naked choke at 434 of the second round. This was a rematch, as Carriasso had beaten Figueroa at Strikeforce Shamrock versus Baroni, where he'd gotten a decision win, and now Ant Dog would seek revenge, but unfortunately, he would not be able to get it. The fight was all Carriasso, pretty much from start to finish. He would take down Figueroa in both rounds, eventually working in the rear naked choke finish close to the end of the second. Big win for Carriasso, for sure.
Yeah, this was a good fight. Figueroa was totally outmatched, unable to counter the takedown, and he could not fight off his back, and this was pretty one-sided.
Yeah, but Carriasso would get his chance on the bigger stages in MMA. He'd go on a long run in the WEC and the UFC, fought exclusively for those two promotions from 2010 to 2015, faced some huge names like Henry Cejudo, Demetrius Johnson, who he actually got a flyweight title, UFC flyweight title shot against, and Sergio Pettis, lost to all them. He did get wins over Luis Smolka and Takiya Mizugaki. He retired in 2015 with a 17-8 record. As for his opponent, Anthony "Ant Dog" Figueroa, got to be hard to lose two bouts to the same fighter. This would actually be the last that we would see of both these guys, but of Figueroa in Strikeforce. He was done with the promotion after this. He would never quite make it to another big promotion. He ended his career at 10-8-1 in 2017. He's still training fighters and recently cornered one at a Bellator event. And some breaking news. I actually, as we record this, got in touch with Anthony earlier today, and he's going to be our guest on our next episode. I'm looking forward to talking with him, a guy that was part of Strikeforce for several of their events early on. He comes from Kung Lee's fight team. He opened a gym up in Gilroy, actually, which is south of San Jose. I lived there. I actually trained a couple times at his gym and worked with him a little bit. And so we've reconnected, and he's going to be our guest. And I'm looking forward to this. This is not something where we're having a massive Strikeforce star on the show, but we're having somebody that was an important part of the undercard of several Strikeforce events. And so I want to talk about things from his perspective and talk about, you know, what it was like to be a fighter at his level, and of course what he's up to now. So I'm looking forward to that, and that will be our next interview episode. So yeah, hope everybody else is looking forward to that as well. All right, the next fight, 185-pound fight. Jeremiah Metcalf defeated Raymond Daniels via submission, coming by way of rear naked choke at 59 seconds of the second round. This fight was intended to be a showcase for Daniels, and it was going to be his MMA debut. And the press release announcing this fight really laid it on thick, so I'm going to read a couple quotes from the press release, if you'll bear with me. Quote, already being hailed as the second coming of Strikeforce World Middleweight Champion Kung Lee, cut in right there, talk about some pressure. The second coming of the guy that just won the middleweight title. But anyways, Daniels recognizes the number one sport karate fighter in the world, holds a 6th degree black belt in Kenpo and Shotokan karate, as well as a 5th degree black belt in Taekwondo. He packs a thrilling, dynamic fighting style that is strikingly similar to Lee. You see what he did there with strikingly similar. See what he did there. Also a guru of traditional martial arts. I'm going to give MMA fans something they've never seen before, said Daniels, a resident of Long Beach, California. I want to become the greatest fighter of all time. Anybody that steps in front of me is just going to be on my next highlight reel, an obstacle that's standing in my path to greatness. End quote.
Oh, my God.
Quite a mouthful there. However, Daniels was stepping in right into the fire with an opponent like Jeremiah Metcalf. He was 8-4, and he was riding a 3-fight win streak. Before the opening bell, I want to point out Daniels did something that in all my years of watching fights, I've never seen before. He did this kind of samurai pose in the corner with this like little booty shake dance thing and then spun around to face Metcalf. It was weirdly entertaining. Josh, did you see that? Did that stand out to you?
Oh my goodness. This is exactly the kind of thing I'd want to comment on. I'm so mad at myself. I must have checked my phone or something because I don't remember this.
You need to go back. Well, so, okay, to be fair, the camera was not focused on him. It was one of those, like, crane shots from, like kind of far away. So it wasn't like the camera was, like, you know, in tight on him or anything like that. The camera was kind of far away when he did it, so you had to kind of be watching for it. And not that I was like purposely watching for it or anything, but it caught my attention. I was like, what was that? And I like ran it back and I'm like, what was that, dude? Seriously. So go back and look at that.
Phil, if you found a booty shake dance weirdly entertaining, I'm gonna watch that and I'm gonna comment on our next show.
It was weirdly entertaining. So but once the fight started, Metcalf just, I mean, overwhelmed Daniels. I mean, he knew he needed to get the fight to the ground right away. And Metcalf grabbed a clinch and dragged Daniels to the mat. And that's where the fight stayed pretty much the entire time. And Metcalf got in a really tight rear naked choke from the top and with blood and what looked like snot or maybe saliva kind of coming out of his face. Daniels was forced to tap out. And it was all Metcalf, really.
Yeah, this was a really impressive fight. I thought that Metcalf adjusted well. Daniels, I thought at the beginning he came in kind of hot. He came in with a sense of urgency, and Metcalf adjusted. There was a submission attempt where Daniels almost looked like, you know, he may have had it him fully. I think it was sort of like, I don't know if you remember the exact one, but it was sort of like a neck crank. He had him in sort of a side headlock, and Metcalf just was calm, cool. He pulled out of it and it was all over. He just jumped on him and stayed on top of him and just, you know, would not let him breathe. And so I thought that was a bit of a comeback, and I was happy to see that he was resilient enough. Do you remember that hold that he had him in? It was sort of like he was standing and he was trying to choke him out, but he didn't really have it in, but he was trying to sink it in.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of getting in or getting out of anything, I mean, Metcalf just, it was just not a fair fight in the end. I mean, this is what happens when you have boxers or kickboxers come in and just think they can just come in and do what they do in the ring, and that they think they can just come in the cage and do the same thing. It's why when people talk about a guy like Mayweather coming in, it's, dude, anybody...
Mayweather wouldn't last 30 seconds.
No, because what'll happen is an MMA fighter will get inside and they'll take you down, they'll trip you and take you down, and you'll end up on your back, and then your punches don't do anything from the bottom, and then that's it. Like, it's how it works. So as long as the guy doesn't try to play your game, if you're a boxer or a kickboxer, you've just got pretty much no chance other than the guy being dumb and staying on the feet with you. So, and that's exactly what we saw, you know, and so, yeah, but this would be it for Metcalf and Strikeforce. Daniels would also be one and done, but we have got to talk about Raymond Daniels. I did not recognize the name. I did not recognize who he was until I started doing my research. Dude, this guy came back into MMA after a long hiatus, and this is the guy that landed the spinning jumping 720 right hand in Bellator in 2019 to get one of the greatest KOs in MMA history. Do you know what I'm talking about, Josh? Did you see that?
No, I don't. Does not ring a bell at
You
all.
need to look that up. Like, just look up like 720 KO Bellator or something like that, because that like, in fact, do me a favor, look it up now while I'm talking and see if you can find it, because it is one of the greatest KOs. It looks like something out of a movie, but I mean, it's, and I we'll find it and we'll tweet it out and post it and all that stuff. But Daniels just fought in Bellator as we record this in November 2020. He just fought in Bellator in September, and he had the fight stopped for accidental low blows, which I actually remember seeing that replay too. And then on top of all that, he married Sage Northcutt's sister in 2019. So Daniels is all up in MMA now. He's back. I had no idea that he'd ever fought in MMA before, but before coming back in, Daniels has had this amazing run in kickboxing, including winning eight straight in Bellator kickboxing, which I've heard of Bellator kickboxing, but I didn't know, realize that it was still going. But he's the welterweight champion in Bellator kickboxing, and overall, he's 35-3 in kickboxing. I had no idea that he had gone. I didn't realize who he was, and now I do. So yeah, pretty amazing. And I'm gonna.
Well, I just, sorry to interrupt, but I just watched it, and that was Kerry Von Erich right there.
Yeah, that was a tornado punch. Absolutely.
But I mean, it was like, you're right. It was like a 720. You got to watch it. You got to slow it down. You got to watch it a few times to exactly see how he did this. But it was almost like if he were on skates, it would have been like a triple Lutz or something. You know, he just like spun in the air, and then, God, can you imagine being that guy? I mean, how embarrassing. Like, it's bad enough you're getting knocked out. You're knocked out with like a, you know, highlight reel TV sort of punch that is never going to happen again, probably.
Yeah, I you got to feel for the guy that you got to feel for the guy that got knocked out. But that was an incredible, incredible strike. And so,
how about longevity for that guy?
I mean, yeah, sticking with it this long.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll look to get him on the show. I think that'd be a pretty fascinating conversation. So maybe we'll look to do that. But yeah. All right. So that closes out the undercard. Now we're on the main card. At 185 pounds, Eric Lawson defeated Jesse Gillespie via submission, coming by way of rear naked choke at 103 of the first round. Both Lawson and Gillespie had fought in Strikeforce before, with Lawson getting a real nice win over Josh Neal at 4 minute in or One Man Survives, while Gillespie had beaten Dave Martin and lost to Jesse Jones inside the Hexagon to open up his MMA career. Weirdly, MMA Weekly's recap has no mention of this fight. I think this fight actually took place after the main event. I think this was a swing bout, and I'm guessing that whoever MMA Weekly had in the house to cover the event didn't realize that there was another fight, or didn't want to be there for another fight. Mm-hmm. And so he took off. So all we know is the result. We don't actually have a breakdown of the actual action, but being that it was 63 seconds long and it was a submission, you know, I mean, I'd say a lot can happen in a minute inside the cage. So who knows, but all we, you know, it obviously was a good win for Lawson, and both these guys will be back in Strikeforce, and actually at the same show, they'd both be back for Strikeforce at the Playboy Mansion too. So we'll be discussing them more in the future. All right. At 145 pounds, Miesha Tate defeated Elena Maxwell via unanimous decision. This would be Cupcake versus Beef. Two of the more unique nicknames in MMA.
She's not Cupcake yet, though.
She was not Cupcake yet. True, that is true. So I guess we'll let that slide. But
you know,
still,
I do my deep research on this show, Phil.
Okay, so. Okay. Well, you scooped me there. But it's just weird for two confectionery, you know, two food nicknames to be going up against each other, even if they weren't actually. Didn't have those nicknames at that time. But easy for me to say. Tate would be making her Strikeforce debut. Maxwell had lost to Junior Carano in the first ever Strikeforce women's fight So here we go. Getting into it, Misha got the fight to the mat very early, worked her ground game the whole first round. She got an armbar on, but Maxwell defended well. With just a few seconds left, Tate got it fully locked in, and you could see the arm hyperextending. The horn went off, and it was so close that Maxwell wasn't even sure if the ref hadn't stopped the fight. Pretty remarkable.
I saw a tap. Like, I don't know if you saw the tap. I saw the tap. She tapped.
I don't remember seeing a tap.
Maybe you want to go back and watch it. She did like a three little soft tap, and then she changed her mind, and the round was over. But anyway, I thought that was interesting. Actually, I was kind of impressed by Maxwell. I did like the fact that she was able to try to fight off the armbar. At one point, she kind of wrapped her legs around Tate's head, and she fought it for as long as she could. Most of the time, you see them just trying to hold their own arm with one hand against the other person, trying to pull with two arms to straighten out the arm. And I hadn't seen somebody try to roll their legs up on their opponent and actually squeeze to buy time. Tate was relentless on top. I mean, she really wanted that submission. She showed a lot of fire. But yeah, I felt like she tapped. And they showed some replays, and it looked like she did. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, maybe she didn't tap her own body. She was just almost tapping three times, but it looked like a tap to me.
Well, the fact that she was basically like asking the ref afterward, like, did you stop it? Like once the horn went off to end the round, that lends credibility to the idea that she maybe did tap. And so she was like, you know, is it over? And yeah, so I guess that makes sense, you know, but regardless, she would end up losing the fight anyway, so I guess in the end it didn't matter. But the second round was almost a replay of the first, with Tate getting a takedown right away. Maxwell kind of kept out of trouble, and she survived in the end. But Tate was – it was all Tate in the second round too.
Yeah, it was basically how long is it going to take Tate to actually pull this off. Maxwell fought well to defend herself, but there was only one direction this fight was headed.
Yeah, absolutely. Maxwell probably won the third round. She used her ground game, but it really wasn't enough, as she needed a finish after two dominating rounds from Tate. So we saw a unanimous decision victory for Misha.
Yeah, I like Maxwell. I thought she was game. She did a good job. Tate obviously would become one of the biggest female fighters in Strikeforce and the UFC. She never did. I shouldn't say that. You know, she eventually won the UFC championship, and she beat Holly Holm, who conquered Ronda. So that was a great thing for her. But it's going to be cool to watch Misha as her rise here, much like we have been watching with Gilbert Melendez and Kung Lee and Josh Thompson.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm looking forward to talking more about her. But Maxwell would not fight in Strikeforce again. She would end her career at 7-4 in 2012. Tate, of course, would become a big part of Strikeforce, as we just briefly discussed. Eventually, she would win the women's bantamweight title and set up one of the biggest feuds in Strikeforce and really women's MMA history with Ronda Rousey. So we'll be discussing her a lot more in the future. All right, we're to the first of our two Strikeforce title fights. At 205 pounds, Bobby Southworth defeated Anthony Ruiz via unanimous decision to retain the Strikeforce light heavyweight title. As mentioned, this was a rematch, this time with the title on the line. Ruiz, while he had, after the fight with Southworth, had stayed active. He beat Jimmy Ambriz and Brad Imes, who I think was called the Hillbilly Heartthrob, I think was his nickname when he was on the Ultimate Fighter and in the UFC, if I remember correctly, something like that. I think he was he's a pretty big guy, and I think he ended up being a firefighter, but yeah, I think he was the Hillbilly Heartthrob. Anyways, Ruiz beat both those guys in regional promotion. Southworth had been on the sidelines since that fight, and this was a big shot for Ruiz. I mean, Ruiz got that big TKO win over the champ. We've talked before, I'm not really a fan of non-title fights. And for champions. And so this, not really a huge, big, not a huge fan of that. And Ruiz kind of, gone short end of the stick because he could have been the champion coming into this. But Kung Lee, the newly minted Strikeforce middleweight champion, joined the commentators for this one. Very nice first round for the champion. Southworth almost got a nice armbar locked in. Good showing for him. Ruiz was looking a little tired to open up the second, but he did do better getting top position for a bit. But this fight was really a grind. That was really the story of this fight. Both fighters were tired heading into the third round. A lot more mat work with that round, and then in the fourth and the fifth, and just not really an exciting fight. I mean, strategically, very smart game plan for the champion. It paid off with a unanimous decision victory, but really not an aesthetically pleasing fight at all. Southworth would be back to defend his title against Babalu Sobral 5 months after this bout, while Ruiz would be back at the next Playboy Mansion show. But really not a whole lot to that fight, you know, really not a whole lot to discuss. It was pretty workmanlike and not the most exciting. So
yeah, I mean, I've talked before about Bobby Southworth and just, I don't know, no X factor. And so I thought the fight was just pretty average.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that's a fair assessment. All right, moving forward, 155 pounds. Billy Evangelista defeated Nam Phan via split decision. Evangelista was 6-0 and overall and 3-0 in Strikeforce coming into this one. He just beat Marlon Sims via stoppage at Shamrock versus Lee. Clearly primed to make a real statement at 155 pounds, maybe even set himself up to be a title challenger. Phan was 14-4. He had lost to Josh Thompson at Strikeforce Triple Threat in December of 2006, then gone 3-1, including a win over Saeed Awad, all outside the confines of the hexagon. The fight itself, this was a real war, very close fight. Lots of back and forth, Phan doing more on the feet, Evangelista doing more damage on the mat. They both worked hard, scored points, but it was Evangelista that got the split decision nod in the end, which I agreed with. Very good overall fight, very entertaining. Evangelista would be back multiple times in Strikeforce, including at the next Strikeforce event, Payback. Phan wouldn't compete for Strikeforce again, but he would make it onto the Ultimate Fighter Season 12. He would then have a long run in the UFC, getting wins over Leonard Garcia, who is one of my favorite all-time fighters, by the way, and Cole Miller. Phan also tried his hand at boxing, but that has not gone very well. He has a record of 3-8-1. He's on a combined 0-7 run in MMA and boxing, having last competed in 2018. All right, we have finally arrived. We are at the main event, so here we go. Josh Thompson defeated Gilbert Melendez via unanimous decision to win the Strikeforce lightweight title. Thompson was riding a 6-fight win streak coming into this title bout, having rebounded from his loss at Shamrock versus Gracie, which was Strikeforce's first event, against Clay Guida in a fight to decide the promotion's first lightweight champion. Then in his most recent bout, he dispatched Adam Lynn at the first Playboy Mansion show the previous September. Clearly, the punk was on a roll, and his injured shoulder that had postponed this fight earlier in 2008 had seemingly recovered. Melendez, for his part, had righted the ship after losing for the first time in Japan by TKOing little-regarded but durable Gabe Lemley at Shamrock versus Lee. Josh, as you mentioned, Thompson and Melendez were extremely familiar with each other, even considered each other to be a friend. They had trained and even sparred with one another, so they knew their opponent's style, habits, strengths, weaknesses very, very well, which would make for an extremely interesting fight. Melendez, in a pre-fight interview, had said that he had been training with his usual crew of Jake Shields and the Diaz brothers with the, I don't think he'd been nicknamed the scrap pack quite yet, but that he had also headed down to San Diego and trained with Diego Sanchez for a while, which is interesting because Melendez and Sanchez would actually eventually fight in the UFC, with Melendez getting the decision win in that one. So this was shaping up to be a very interesting fight.
And Gilbert's only UFC win, by the way, which is
that's
very
call.
Remarkable when you think about that. So yeah, this, we're going to talk about this. This is a fantastic a fight. You know, two guys on the rise, and we got to see them on full display. Wrestling Observer Weekly said about the fight at this time, which may have played into a little bit of this idea that maybe Melendez underestimated Josh Thompson a little bit, but Thompson was coming off shoulder surgery and said he wasn't ready for the fight. Plus, he was battling a chest cold and a staph infection in recent weeks. There were people who thought that he was making excuses in the event that he would lose to Melendez, whether it was mind games to throw Melendez off. It was the best Thompson has ever looked, as he dominated every facet of the match, from Wrestling Observer Weekly.
Oh, interesting. I didn't realize that he was sick and hurting before the fight, but this is, yeah, so, to borrow from Michael Cole, this is vintage Josh Thompson. I mean, this is his game. And
yeah,
I agree. He dominated every facet of the match. But so let's get into the fight itself. Nice takedown D from Josh in the first. He got a takedown of his own early on. Gil had his moments in the first, but I have to give it to Josh, 10-9 for sure. But I wanted to say something about Josh. I mean, having watched several of his fights in a row now, he just always looked like he was having fun and really enjoying himself in the cage. I mean, in this fight specifically, he smiled, he winked, he was energetic. I mean, just his passion and his enjoyment of what he does just bleeds through. I mean, he's literally one of the guys that the few guys that I can think of that I just remember having a smile on his face so often when he was in the cage. I mean, it really stood out to me, and it definitely stood out in this fight.
Yeah, it feels like Josh Thompson is playing beach volleyball inside the hexagon. I mean, that's how relaxed he is. He's having fun. It's almost as though he's not risking his life inside a cage. He's just out there doing his thing. And so there's something about him where he was able to lose his mind, separate himself from the reality, and just become so relaxed in that cage. And against Melendez in this fight, Melendez was stiff. He was a lot more stiff than we have seen him. He looked a lot more nervous.
Not like pro wrestling stiff. You mean like just in his movements and everything?
Yeah, no, he was not Lex Luger stiff or Ultimate Warrior stiff by any means. He was just kind of not as fluid as he normally is inside the hexagon. Where, you know, Josh, you know, you hit on a good point is, you know, like a Conor McGregor, every time he fights, he's totally in control and he's putting on this show and this persona and he's trying to intimidate his opponent. And so he's really relaxed. Nick Diaz, Nate Diaz, they have some of these qualities too, but you can tell it's very much like, I'm going to intimidate you. But Josh, it's something very unique. It's just like he's hanging out with his buddies in the backyard, goofing off. It's a very unique quality. And I think that's what makes him so entertaining to watch fight, because he's so comfortable and in control.
Yeah, and it very much showed through in this fight for sure. So I thought Josh looked great. And so let's continue on. The fight stayed on the feet in the second round. And I mean, just what a battle. You know, I mean, these two were trading shots and clinches, with Gil getting a couple nice shots in. However, as the second round wore on, I feel like Josh was clearly getting the upper hand and gaining more confidence. Got a nice takedown just as the buzzer went. Had a big smile on his face after that, because he knew that he probably sealed the round with that.
Josh sort of resembled a rabbit to me in terms of the way he was moving. He was bouncing around. He was quick, not sudden. Or was it sudden, not quick? This is a Gordon Solie reference. He
Yeah.
was so much faster than Gilbert. It was amazing. He was one step ahead. And I don't know if Gilbert thought that Josh was just not going to be ready to go, but Thompson was just he fought a strategically better fight, and he was anticipating what Gilbert would do, and he was not letting Gilbert go there. And
Yep.
That's what was unique. It was a smart fight so
Yeah.
far for Josh.
I think they out I really think AKA out strategized Gracie's team with this one. I mean, I think they just had such a perfect game plan. This was the epitome of coming in prepared for your opponent and knowing what they were going to do, and then keeping them from doing it for sure. But Josh's takedown D, I mean, it was just straight up on point. Gil was losing on the feet, couldn't get it to the mat, and that continued on in the third round. Melendez realized, and I'm sure his corner was telling him, you need to be more aggressive. But Thompson was just able to withstand and fire back constantly, and it was another clear round for Josh.
And I think Gilbert Melendez started to tire a bit in this round. You could see him taking deep breaths. His mouth was open big. You know, he tried to step up the action, but Josh said, I'm not having this. Like, you're not going to intimidate me. He fired back. And every time Gilbert decided I was going to use my boxing skills, Josh said, I'm going to use mine right back at you. And so he never gave Gilbert Melendez an opportunity to feel confident, to get in a groove, to get any kind of momentum. He was making Gilbert pay for everything that he was trying to dish out. And so if you're getting counterpunched when you're trying to throw a right hand, then you're less likely to punch. And that's what was happening. So Josh was just very much fearless in this round.
Yeah, he was beating Gil to the punch, no question about it. But we were now in the championship rounds. In the fourth, Gil, whose corner had told him to press and put Josh on his back foot, kept moving forward. However, Josh got a couple nice takedowns, squelching any of Gil's momentum. He then turned one of them into a pretty tight jaw crank from behind with the hooks in. And, you know, it's Josh, you've probably watched enough fights like me. You've probably watched enough fights to realize when a guy is really in trouble. You kind of recognize when a body is contorted a certain way, or there's a certain look on his face, or there's a certain look in his eyes that, okay, I think this one's going to be it. I think he's got him. And I knew that Josh won by decision, but if I was seeing this fight live for the first time, or I didn't know the outcome, I would have thought he might have had Gil, because he had that jaw crank, and I don't think that's the right name for the move. I don't know what you call it, where you have your arm around their jawline instead of underneath the neck or underneath mm-hmm. the throat. But you know, he had him on pretty tight and had the hooks in, and it looked like he was in trouble, but Gil persevered. And after the round, Josh was smiling, super confident. I mean, he knew that he had this fight won. If he could just make it to the final bell, he knew that this was over.
Yeah, this is the round.
Real quick, that was a stupid thing to say. He knew if he made it to the final bell that this was over. Doesn't matter who it is, if you make it to the final bell, it's over. So that was kind of dumb. But he knew that if he made it to the final bell, that he would win. So there you go.
You're right. You know, you just reminded me. Had that round gone on a little bit longer, he might have submitted him. You know, I think it was the fact that, well, the bell sounded, and also, people may not know, obviously, if you're a fight fan or if you fought, it's like, well, why doesn't Josh just squeeze him harder? You know, it takes a lot of energy to try to submit somebody, and you can only do that so long. And then Gilbert's fighting back. So, you know, this is already the fourth round. So, yeah, I think Gilbert got lucky that by the time he put on this hold, it was the end of the round. But he might have gone there. I don't know if Gilbert would have went out or if he would have tapped. Gilbert eventually did tap to Anthony Pettis, you know, so I don't know if Gilbert would have gone to sleep or not, but Josh Thompson definitely was the man in this round as well.
Yep, he was the man in all five of them. I mean, yeah. It's just the way it was. But in the fifth and last round, Thompson got Gil on the mat early, and other than that, the fight stayed on the feet in that final round. You've got to hand it to both guys. I mean, Gil kept pushing, looking for a Hail Mary, while Josh, to his credit, he did not play it safe. He was still engaging and battling and seeing if he could get a finish, but incredible gas tank for both fighters, just especially Josh. I mean, so superbly conditioned, and especially in this fight. And in the end, there was no question that Thompson had won. Huge respect between the fighters afterwards, hugs and handshakes. I mean, just an amazing battle, and the heart and skill displayed by both was something to remember, and probably Thompson's crowning achievement in a very successful career. So good stuff. Hats off to both fighters, but Josh was definitely the better man on this night.
Yeah, I think Gilbert was just not prepared. He didn't expect Thompson to come in with his A-plus game. And Melendez was thinking, you know, I could probably win this with my B-plus, A-minus effort. And he learned, and he paid the price. Thompson also, I mean, he's always in good shape. He's skinny and muscular. But in this fight, I mean, he looked amazing. I mean, he was in such good physical shape. And Gilbert just... he got tired, you know, and he's outmatched. He's getting beat to the punch, and he's exhausted. I mean, all you're really doing there is hoping for a crazy sort of knockout. And, you know, the thing, and I think you'll talk about this in a second probably, is that just Thompson was busier. You know, he threw more kicks. He threw punches. He did takedowns. He was more versatile. The only thing I didn't like about this was the announcers basically talking the entire fifth round about how Josh was the next champion, and I thought that it took a little bit away from the Hail Mary miracle shot that Gilbert, you know, may have had. You always have a shot no matter what. So I didn't like that, but that's more of an aesthetic thing. But I thought that Josh was just really spectacular in a game plan. Remind me of Holly Holm versus Ronda Rousey. Just, you know, let's do the thing that no one else has ever done to Ronda. And it helps that we're also so, you know, 5'10 or whatever she was. Just winning the fight on the drawing board. That's what happened here.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. 100%. I did want to mention there was, I found a, I have not seen this yet, but I, as far as my research goes for this podcast, but I was able to find a page on the UFC site that laid out some fight stats for this. And here's a few that stand out. Thompson landed 42% of his significant strikes to only 19% for Melendez. Melendez threw no leg kicks, which was interesting. But probably the biggest stat was that Thompson secured 6 of his 9 takedown attempts. Melendez was 0 for 8, 0 for 8 on takedowns. And so that's probably the difference right there. I mean, so much of Melendez, yeah, he's obviously he's got good striking, but so much of his game involves him grounding and pounding. And so when you can't get to the ground, you can't pound. And that spells, you know, a loss for Melendez. So I think that was the biggest difference right there. And Gilbert would be out for 10 months after this fight. He would return to the cage at Shamrock versus Diaz. Thompson would be back at the second Playboy Mansion show in a non-title fight, which we will discuss on an episode very soon. But yeah, that's it for Melendez versus Thompson as far as the event itself. So let's wrap things up and we'll call it a day. But no fighters pop for drugs of abuse or performance enhancers after Melendez versus Thompson. As mentioned, the event drew 7,288 fans for a gate of $355,487. Again, the UFC event that the major one that was closest to this drew over $3 million. I think it was $3.3 million. This one drew 355,000. So again, it just a massive, massive difference. Total disclosed fighter payroll of $203,200. Josh Thompson made $35,000, which included a win bonus of $15,000, while Gilbert Melendez made $50,000. Bobby Southworth made $25,000, which included a $10,000 win bonus. Interestingly, Anthony Ruiz only got paid $200, but that was because he received most of his undisclosed pay in an advance prior to the fight, which I've never heard of. I'm sure it's happened, but I personally don't remember ever reading something like that. That was interesting. Misha Tate got paid $1,500. That's it. Now, she was only 1-1 coming into this, so she was, you know, she's not the Misha Tate of today, but she only made $1,500, which included a win bonus of $500. Elena Maxwell got $4,000. Billy Evangelista took in $14,000, including a $7,000 win bonus, while Nam Phan got $10,000. And again, if you want to see the full list of pay, it's out there. But overall, sorry, go ahead.
I just, you know, we need to do a whole entire podcast on fighter pay. It's just insane that anyone's putting their life on the line on TV in a reputed promotion for $1,500.
You know? Yeah. Just, I mean, you know, look, the event itself made $355,000 at the gate, and fighter payroll was $200 of that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I mean, how much more are you going to pay them? And even if you threw $10K on everybody, that's still not that much money in comparison to training costs and, again, putting your health on the line. So it's like I said, I'm going to dissuade my kids from getting into fighting for money if I can help it.
Or they need to go the CM Punk route, you know?
Yeah, so yeah. Just become a huge star. 500
grand on your first fight.
Become a huge star somewhere else and then, you know, and then go into it. But overall, a pretty entertaining event. Thompson put on a really masterful display, executed a perfect strategy against Melendez by stuffing every takedown attempt and also not getting caught up in a firefight on the feet. Southworth retained his light heavyweight title, but once again, probably didn't gain a ton of new fans. He was just a grinder. I mean, that was his style. The Raymond Daniels experiment fizzled pretty quickly, and then we saw a potential new women's star in Misha Tate. So, kind of, you know, a lot of moving parts from this. Josh, what did you think?
Well, the main event was great. Obviously, we just talked about that. Two of these tremendous young fighters who were giving their all. They're not even in their primes yet, you know. They're right there. I think the show was hurt overall by the lack of other big names on the card. Obviously, we had Bobby Southworth on there, but I think it was just a lot of people were not familiar with, and there were a lot of fighters in the lower weights. And I think you need a good mix. You need to have a couple of named fighters, you know, throw in a heavyweight there, or just a couple of chances for some more impressive knockouts. Unfortunately, there was a lot of ground game, a lot of sort of stuff that had turned off a lot of the mainstream people before Griffin Bonner was this great stand-up fight. So I think it was hurt a little bit by that. Obviously, you can't control that, but you can do that through booking. And I think the bigger theme here is, you know, we've watched enough of these shows now, Phil, where we get a sense of how Strikeforce promotes its cards. And I think the biggest thing is inconsistency, because we've had some really good Strikeforce shows, and then we have ones that have not been so great, like the Bob Sapp one in Seattle. And then you know, this one was leaning more toward average or less than average outside of the main event. So I think that's the big thing with Strikeforce, is just the inconsistency of the cards, the quality of fights. Even this one, we've got, again, a different announce crew, although this, you know, Boss Rutan was amazing. It's just kind of never know how to settle in at this stage when you're watching a Strikeforce card. Obviously, it's memorable because of Thompson and Melendez, and it might have been Thompson's best fight other than the Nate Diaz knockout, which is just, or TKO, which is just one of my favorites. And obviously, it's the birth of Misha Tate.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think that we're realizing that one of the biggest things that Strikeforce had to deal with, especially early on, was just a lack of depth. I mean, you develop your own guys, of course, and they were developing guys like Kung Lee and Luke Stewart and Billy Evangelista and guys like that. But they're just, you know, you really, it's crazy. I mean, they're nowhere near as busy as the UFC, but they don't have enough big name fighters to fill up a card like this. I mean, and they were, by the way, you got to realize they were going to do the Josh Thompson Gilbert Melendez fight on the same card as Shamrock versus Lee. I think it was better for them that fight didn't happen, because then they could main event another show with it. But, you know, you realize you're light heavyweight champion. You can't really main event a show with him, because the fights are not that exciting. And so what do you have besides this? And so I think the biggest thing that we see, or the biggest issue that they had early on, was just, again, that lack of depth. And it wouldn't continue. I mean, they would start to really develop stars, and we would see that. But as we go along, I'm interested to see how much of this continued and how long it took to kind of turn the tide on that. All right, coming up next on Inside the Hexagon, we are going to be talking with Anthony Ant Dog Figueroa. I'm looking forward to that. This is going to be an interesting discussion. This is going to be the first time that we talk to a fighter that actually lost on the most recent event episode. So that, I think that's going to be intriguing to kind of get his perspective on that and talk a little bit about Strikeforce in the early days. And so I'm looking forward to reconnecting with Anthony, and that's going to be a good discussion. So look for that next week. The next Strikeforce event that we're going to be covering will be the second and final Playboy Mansion show. On that card, Luke Stewart returns, Joe Riggs returns, though they do not return against each other. Josh Thompson is also back for a quick turnaround, while we see the Strikeforce debut of Mitsuhiro Ishida, who had handed Gilbert Melendez his first loss the previous year. So I'm looking forward to discussing that one with you, Josh. On social media, make sure you check us out at Inside the Hexagon Pod on Instagram. You can also find us on Twitter. Just look for at Hexagon Pod, or again, at Inside the Hexagon Pod. You can also reach me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. Would love to hear from you if you have requests for people you'd like to see on the show, if you have ideas, if you have feedback, anything like that. We want to make sure that we're putting out what you want. So please reach out. Let us know what you think about the show. Would love to hear from you. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. Hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy, and we will see you soon.
Hey there, my name is Michael Laminato, and this is Pit Pass F1, a brand new podcast that'll take you closer to the action of the world's most prestigious motorsport. From Monaco to Miami and Australia to Azerbaijan, Pit Pass F1 is on the ground and has you covered. Esteemed F1 journalists Julianne Serasoli and Chris Medland will take you inside the sport every round. They'll keep you up to date with the latest news breaking in Formula One and the most influential views shaping the world of Grand Prix racing. Every Friday, we'll be bringing you a track guide and race preview, and Chris and Drew will be in your feed every morning from Saturday through to Monday to keep you up to date on all the day's action on and off the track. So if you want to be in the know on the latest in Formula One, subscribe wherever you get your favorite podcasts and visit us at evergreenpodcasts.com. Pit Pass F1, a brand new show for Evergreen Podcasts.